Okay. In the month of October, in the year 1347, in the middle of the, in other words, in the middle of the 14th century, 12 ships coming from the Black Sea docked at the port of Messina in Sicily, in Italy. The people who gathered on the docks when the ship came in were met with a most horrifying and gruesome sight. Most of the sailors who were on board the ship were dead, and those few who were still alive were gravely ill, were covered in black boils that oozed blood and pus. The Sicilian authorities immediately ordered that the fleet of death ships must immediately leave their harbor, but it was too late. Over the next several years, what became known as the Black Death would kill between 20 and perhaps as many as 50 or even more million people in Europe, approximately one-third to, according to some estimates, one-half of the entire population of Europe in just a few years. And the Black Death is also known sometimes simply as the pestilence, the great mortality, the plague, was the deadliest pandemic in recorded human history. And I said there are numerous different estimates as to how many people killed. You did not have the kind of record keeping that we have today. Of course, today we see the numbers are also sometimes skewed. But in those days, they didn't have record keeping mechanisms like we have today. And so it's not clear what the population in some areas was to begin with. So there are people who, you know, numbered at 20 million. Sometimes you see 75 million, a staggering number, something between half and a third of the entire population of Europe. Also parts of North Africa and the Middle East as well. Again, estimates range from 30 to 60% of the population. According to most records, that span of a few years in the late 1340s up through the 1351, plus certain resurgences or other outbreaks later on in the Middle Ages, it took till the year 1500 until the European population regained the levels that it had been at in the year 1300. That's how many people were killed. You do the math in terms of, you know, projected births and so on and so forth. It was, again, the deadliest pandemic in the history of the world. Even before the so-called death ships came into the port in Sicily and Italy, Europeans heard rumors about what they referred to as a great pestilence that was carving a deadly path along the trade routes in the near and far east. And in the early 1340s, the disease had been in China, a certain parallel to today, and India, Persia, Syria, and Egypt. And it's most likely it originated somewhere in Central Asia or perhaps East Asia, where it traveled along what was called the Silk Road, the trading route, and it reached the Crimea, in 1347. It was carried probably by fleas that were living on black rats that inhabited and traveled on the Italian ships and the lower decks and so on. It spread through what's called the Mediterranean Basin, reached Africa, Western Asia, the rest of Europe via Constantinople, Sicily, and the Italian peninsula. And once it came into Europe, it was spread as well by human fleas. And there are differences in terms of the medical conditions, what's called pneumonic plague, person-to-person contact, aerosols, some of the things we're hearing today in the corona pandemic. It was spread through, you know, through air. And it was spread very fast and very quickly, and again, it wreaked havoc. It seemed to have begun, in terms of Europe, with an attack that the Mongols from Eastern Asia, from Asia, launched against Italian merchants in a trading station called Kaffa, which is in the Crimea. Today it's called Feodosia. In the autumn of 1346, a plague broke out among the besiegers, among the Mongols. From there, it penetrated into the town. And eventually the Italians fled on the ships, but the Black Death was already on the ship and fled with them. In the Central Asian area where it's assumed that the plague originated, it was a large rodent population. In the early decades of the 14th century, Asia supposedly suffered a series of ecological events, storms, floods, earthquakes, and these disturbances, again, these are all theories, these disturbances may have led the rodents and other animals out of their to come out of their holes and to go into contact with human beings. And again, this mysterious illness swept through, reached Crimea, okay, where there was it was an important trading hub, the city of Kaffa, which is an important trading hub between the east and the west. And in the 1340s, Kaffa, that city, was attacked by Mongols. The conflict dragged on, and suddenly the Mongols' soldiers began getting sick and dying, their general, the gentleman, maybe he wasn't a gentleman, by the name of Khan Janibeg, and he ordered that the dead corpses be flung over the walls of the city in the hopes that it would infect the city. And the plan seemed to have worked. Again, it's unclear. Some of the records are unclear. But after about a year of this siege, Janibeg's army, was besieged, was hit by this illness, and the plan apparently worked because the people of Kaffa began to fall ill, and the people from Italy, from Genoa, said, time to get out of here, and they did, but on their ships, the rats and infected animals and fleas and so on were already there, okay? So from those places, it seems, the plague swung inward, soon to the west in Greece, to Bulgaria, Romania, from the south to Egypt. And in October 1347, as we mentioned at the beginning, 12 ships, presumably from Kaffa, arrived at the Sicilian port of Messina. And shortly thereafter, many people in the city came down with fever, began to spit up blood. The ships were expelled. Eventually, they found ports, harbors in other ports and so on. The Black Death had entered Europe. So I just want to give a quick overview of the timeline over the couple of years that this disease was spreading through Europe. Again, that was October of 1347. In mainland Italy, where the disease first hit in terms of Europe, one third of the population, which was again, they came in October 1347, one third of the population of the country was dead by the following summer. That's that's how it cut through. November of 1347, the plague arrived in France, brought by another ship to the port of Marseille. It spread quickly through the country. In January of 1348, a different strain of the plague came from a different ship and attacked Italy. They were still recovering from the first strain. And from there, it headed east into the Persian Empire through Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, and south into Egypt and so on. And there were other events that happened at the same time. I just want to read to you from a book that I have here called A Convenient Hatred, The History of Anti-Semitism. And this was edited by Phyllis Goldstein. In this book, on page 95, let's read the quote over here, in terms of it arriving in Syria. The people fasted for three successive days, the religious Muslims. Then they assembled in a great mosque until the place was filled with overflowing. And there they spent the Thursday night in prayers and litanies. After the dawn prayer next morning, they all went out together on foot, holding Qurans in their hand, their Bible. The procession was joined by the entire population of the town, men and women, small and large. The Jews came with their book of the law, and the Christians with their gospel, all of them with their women and children. And so some people's response to this tragedy, of course, was prayer. That was among the religious Muslims in Syria. Venice faced its outbreak. Venice organized the very first communal or organized response with committees ordering ships to be inspected, burning those ships which had contagious people on them, saying, shutting down the taverns. I don't know if we ever did that here. I think the bars remained open. But in Venice, they had the seichel to close down the taverns. Okay, they restricted wine and other products coming from unknown sources. And the canals of Venice were filled with gondolas, those little boats that go up and down the canal, shouting official instructions as to how to dispose of dead bodies. Despite those efforts, the plague killed off 60% of the population of Venice. October 1348, following the infection and death of King Edward III in England, his daughter, not of him, but his daughter, Princess Joan, the plague reached London, and many Londoners fled to the countryside in search of food. King Edward blamed the plague on garbage and human excrement which had piled up in London and in the Thames River. 1349, the plague hit northern England, Wales, brought by people fleeing from southern England, and eventually killed off 100,000 people there. English ships brought the Black Death to Norway. The ship's crew was dead by the time it, by within a week of landing in Norway. The pestilence traveled from there, from Denmark to Sweden. The king believed that fasting on Fridays and foregoing shoes on Sunday, we're not wearing shoes today, they felt that was also a form of penance, fasting on Friday, wearing shoes on Sunday will please God and end the plague, but it didn't work. Two of the king's own brothers died. It moved into Russia and eastern Greenland. The Vikings stopped or halted their exploration of North America at that time. In 1350, in March, Scotland, which had so far avoided being infected by the plague, Scotland had a plan, hoped to take advantage of English weakness by amassing an army and planning an invasion. Not a good idea. While waiting on the border to begin the attack, their troops became ill. 5,000 people of their troops, or the Scottish troops, died. Choosing to retreat, the soldiers brought the disease back to their families, and one third of Scotland perished. In the move to Italy, France, Spain, let's say by, we said by 1348, jumped into England, by 1349, Scandinavia, and so on. 1351, the plague spread significantly begins to peter out, possibly thanks to quarantine efforts, which we'll get to in a moment, after causing the deaths, as we said before, anywhere between 25 million, 50 million or more. In total, Europe had lost about 50% of its population. Some say 33%. Again, we don't know exactly. In the words of the medieval historian Norman Cantor, quote, "Nothing like this has happened before or since in the recorded history of mankind." Just to give a perspective, measured against Europe's population today, the Black Death took the equivalent of almost 2 billion lives. I repeat, measured against the population of Europe today, the Black Death took the equivalent of almost 2 billion lives. Europeans, obviously, at that time were ill-equipped to deal with this horrible disease. The Italian poet Giovanni Boccaccio wrote, "In men and women alike, at the beginning of the malady, certain swellings, either on the groin or under the arms, developed. They grew to the bigness of a common apple, others the size of an egg, some more, some less, and these were named the plague boils and so on. Blood and pus seeped out of these strange swellings, which were then followed by a host of other unpleasant symptoms, fever, chills, vomiting, diarrhea, terrible aches and pains, and then in pretty short order, death." Okay, it's a form of what we call the bubonic plague, boils and so on, and it attacks the lymphatic system, causing swelling and so on. How did it spread? We mentioned before, okay, some again turned to God, and for example, officials in France reported to Philip VI in the late 1300s that it was because of the conjunction of three planets in 1345, the conjunction of the way the planets were, you know, when the moon is aligned with Mars or whatever it is, so whatever aligned that caused that to happen and so on. That was one theory. And of course, as I said before, it was terrifyingly contagious and indiscriminate. Boccaccio, again, the Italian poet, wrote, "The mere touching of clothes appeared to itself communicate the malady to the toucher." Okay? And it was so efficient. It happened so quickly. People who were perfectly healthy when they went to bed at night could be dead by the next morning. That's how fast it was, and that's how devastating it was. You know, just as a side point, the nursery rhyme, some of you know, "Ring around the rosy, pocket full of posy," and so on, was very likely a reference to the symptoms of the Black Death. You know, ashes, ashes, and so on and so forth, and we all fall down dead. It became a nursery rhyme, and that's an interesting thing in its own right. We find similar things in terms of the Holocaust as well, where children made nursery rhymes out of experience that they were having, horrible though they were. Jacob von Königshofen, who was a priest and historian, was a child during the years of the plagues, and he wrote at that time, quote, "Death went from one end of the earth to the other, on that side and this side of the sea. It was greater among the Muslims than among the Christians, at least initially. In some lands, everyone died so that no one was left. Ships were also found on the sea, laden with wares. The crew had all died. No one was guiding the ship. The Bishop of Marseille in France, and priests and monks, and more than half all the people there died with them. In other kingdoms and cities, so many people perished, it would be horrible to describe." He also wrote, "In the matter of this plague, the Jews throughout the world were reviled and accused in all lands of having caused it through the poison they are said to have put into the water in the wells. That is what they were accused of. For this reason, the Jews were burnt all the way from the Mediterranean Sea into Germany," which brings us to what I most wanted to, of course, speak about here. He recorded that there was something, as I said, that was to the fault of the Jews, and of course we suffered for it. Today, scientists understand that the Black Death, which is known as some of the plague and so on, is spread by a type of bacteria called Yersinia pestis. A French biologist, Alexandre Yersin, discovered, if I'm pronouncing correct, I don't know, discovered the germ at the end of the 19th century, and it circulates, as I said before, among rodents, especially when they live in great numbers and great density. That's called a plague focus or a plague reservoir. From there, they affect, normally black rats like to live close to people as opposed to other types of rats, and they did. Normally, it takes 10 to 14 days between before the plague has killed off most of a contaminated rat colony, making it difficult for great numbers of fleas gather on the remaining but soon dying rats to find new hosts. So after 3 days of being hungry, hungry rat fleas turn on humans. From the bite side, the bite site, the disease drains to a lymph node that consequently swells to form a painful bubble, most often in the groin area, on the thigh, the armpit, or the neck, hence the name bubonic plague. The infection takes 3 to 5 days to incubate in people before they fall ill, and another 3 to 5 days before, in 80% of the cases, the victims die. Thus, from the introduction of the plague contagion among rats in a human community, it takes on average 23 days before the first person dies. So, also the bacteria lives better in certain temperatures, so the peak activity or the peak deaths or the peak illness usually came at different times of the year in different locations depending upon the climate. It's known today that the disease does travel from person to person through the air as well as through the bite of the infected fleas and rats, which were all over Europe, and that's how the deadly plague made its way from one European port city to another, as we mentioned. Especially, as I said, along the trade routes. Today, this grim and, I guess, disgusting sequence of events is terrifying, but we at least understand how it happened. Okay, in the middle of the 14th century, with primitive scientific knowledge, primitive medical knowledge, there seemed to be no rational explanation for it whatsoever. Okay, and therefore we know somehow some doctors suggested back then that instantaneous death occurs when the aerial spirit, the shades of the demon, escaping from the eyes of the sick man, strikes the healthy person standing near and looking at the sick. So it was thought by some doctors, all you had to do if you're sick is look at somebody else, you could transmit the disease that way. Okay. Again, as I said, at that time, they knew one thing. It was a tremendous rate of mortality happening very, very quickly. Again, just to summarize some of the numbers, according to a medieval historian, Philip Delidere, okay, it's likely that over 4 years, 50% of the European population died of the plague. The Norwegian historian Ole Benedicto suggests it could have been as much as 60% of the population. Half of Paris's population, 100,000, died. In Italy, the population of Florence was reduced from 110,000 inhabitants in 1338 down to 50,000 in 1351. At least 60% of the population of Hamburg, Paris, similar percentages in London. Florence's tax records suggest that 80% of the city's population died within 4 months in 1348. Even assuming there might have been some people trying to get out of paying taxes, it's still a large number. Before 1350, there were about 170,000 settlements in Germany. This was reduced by nearly 40,000 in 1450. And so that gives you an idea of what the Black Death did in Europe. How do you treat it? Well, at that time, again, crude medical knowledge, unsophisticated techniques. They tried bloodletting, boil lancing, okay, and superstitious practices such as burning herbs, bathing in rose water, bathing in vinegar, if you want to try that. That was what people did. They felt that it was a way that they could treat the disease, but nothing really seemed to help. Basically, people understood that this was a disaster, and so many healthy people did everything they could to avoid the sick people. Doctors refused to see patients. Priests refused to administer last rites. Shopkeepers closed their stores. Many people fled the cities for the countryside, but it affected animals too, cows, sheep, goats, pigs, chickens, and so on. In fact, there were so many sheep that died that one of the consequences of the Black Death after it was all over was a tremendous wool shortage. Okay, in the words of Boccaccio, thus doing each sought to secure immunity for himself. Now, the historian Barbara W. Tuckman, in her book A Distant Mirror, has a chapter on the Black Death. She writes, and I quote, "There were many to echo the account of inhumanity and few to balance it, for the plague was not the kind of calamity that inspired mutual cooperation. Its loathness and deadliness did not herd people together in mutual distress, but only prompted their desire to escape each other. A Franciscan friar in Sicily stated, magistrates and notaries refused to come and make out the wills of the dying. Even the priests did not come to hear their confessions or hear last rites. A clerk of the Archbishop of Canterbury reported the same of English priests who turned away from the care of their children in the church because of fear of death. Cases of parents deserting children. We read in Megillas Eicha about people eating the flesh of their children. So here too, cases of parents deserting children and children deserting parents were reported across Europe from Scotland to Russia. The calamity chilled the hearts of man, wrote Boccaccio in his famous account of the plague in Florence, that serves as the introduction to his Decameron, famous work by Boccaccio. One man shunned another, kinsfolk held aloof. Brother was forsaken by brother, husband by wife. Nay, what is more and scarcely to be believed, mothers and fathers were found to abandon their own children to their fate, untended, alone, unvisited, as if they'd been complete strangers. The great Renaissance poet Petrarch wrote this and was sure that it would not be believed, that later generation would not believe what took place. He wrote, quote, "O happy posterity, who will not experience such abysmal woe, and will look upon our testimony as a fable." Okay, that's what they thought, that no one would believe it. A chronicler in Florence relates that, quote, "All the citizens did little else except to carry dead bodies to be buried. At every church, they dug deep pits down to the water table, and thus those who were poor who died during the night were bundled up quickly and thrown into the pit. In the morning, when a large number of bodies were found in the pit, they took some earth, shoveled it down on top of them, and later others were placed on top of them, and then yet another layer of earth, just," and writing like a good Italian, "just as one makes lasagna with layers of pasta and cheese." Those bodies, layers, graves, or layers of bodies and dirt. And the accounts are remarkably similar elsewhere. Agnolo di Tura from Tuscan in Italy writes, "In many places in Siena, great pits were dug and piled deep with the multitude of dead, and there were also those who were so sparsely covered with earth that the dogs dragged them forth and devoured many bodies throughout the city." De Tura wrote about himself in May of 1348, "Father abandoned child, wife, husband, one another. Okay, for this illness seemed to strike through the breath and sight. And so they died, and none could be found to bury the dead, for money or friendship. Members of a household brought their dead to a ditch," bring out your dead, right? "Brought their dead to a ditch as best they could, without priest, without divine offices. Great pits were dug and piled deep with the multitude of dead. And they died by the hundreds, both day and night. And as soon as those ditches were filled, more were dug. I, Agnolo di Turo," the author of this, writes, "I buried my 5 children with my own hands. And there were also those who were so sparsely covered with earth that the dogs dragged them out and devoured them. And there was no one who wept for any death, for all awaited death. And many died, believed that it was the end of the world." What was the reaction of people in terms of their behavior? Well, as we've read before, Muslim religious scholars taught that the pandemic was a martyrdom and mercy from God. For non-believers, it was a punishment. As some suggest that you shouldn't do anything because it's the will of God. People didn't understand the biology of the disease, so they felt there certainly was some form of a divine punishment. It was a sin against God for whatever, for greed, for blasphemy, heresy, fornication, worldliness, whatever you were inclined to think caused these kinds of things. Why should God be angry at Christian Europe? Well, some pointed to the corruption of the church. That's an old story, and that raised its head numerous times in medieval history. Corruption of the church, okay? Of course, that's not what the church claimed. Others said God was angry as a result of divisiveness that existed within the Christian church. Okay, at this time, England and France were fighting a war called the Hundred Years' War, which actually lasted for more than 100 years. There was robbery. There was Naples and Sicily. The Papal States were always at war with each other. Others said that the plague was the punishment of the Christians not pursuing the Crusades to the utmost and removing the Muslims from the Holy Land. In the centuries before, there were numerous Crusades, as you know. They never succeeded in eliminating the Muslims from Italy. And again, that was failed. So people felt that they should have continued that. Of course, it was a losing battle, but it's a different point. And after a while, to come to our issue, there was a new idea among European Christian masses as to why the Black Death was ravaging their country, because they allowed the Jews to live in their midst as Jews. And this became a widely accepted reason. And therefore, in many communities throughout Christian Europe, the formula for saving the community from the plague lay in either converting, exiling, or obliterating, murdering the Jewish population. And that's how they're going to win God's mercy and so on. At that time, there was a group of individuals that suddenly appeared, religious Christian men, known as flagellants, okay? They were upper-class men who traveled with flagellants. Flagellants were people who would whip themselves, beat themselves. They traveled from town to town with public displays of penance and punishments. They would beat themselves and each other with heavy leather straps that had sharp pieces of metal attached to it while the townspeople looked on. And they would stay and come to a town for 33 and a half days or so. And they did this ritual 3 times a day. And they would go to the next town immediately thereafter and repeat the process. Now, this movement did provide some comfort to people who felt powerless. They felt it was something. However, this was not endorsed, to say the least, by the church, and eventually the movement petered out. But while they were busy engaging in this unusual, shall we say, unusual practice. They figured, well, while we're in town beating each other up with these straps and so on and so forth, well, why not beat up the Jews as well? After all, they're to blame for part of this. And so they would take their leather whips and their iron things attached to it, beating themselves to cause themselves to bleed, but taking it over, taking it out as well on Jews in their local communities. It's interesting, just as a side point before I go further with the Jews, did the Black Death ever end? It never really ended. Okay, and it came back at different times. However, as I mentioned, there were areas that were able to learn how to contain it, and they established what we call today social distancing, and they kept people apart from each other. As a matter of fact, sailors were initially held on their ship when they came into a town for 30 days. It was later increased to 40 days, hence the term quarantine, Q-U-A-R, like a quarter is four. Okay, the term quarantine, which we hear use of today, of course, the term quarantine was 40 days originally, and it's a practice still used today. And in our own time, we've got Eretz Yisrael now, the quarantine is, I think, 2 weeks. But the original term quarantine from Q-A-R had to do with 40 days. Why 40 days? Well, basically because of religious reasons. Okay, 40, the number 40 had significance. When God, there were references to the Mabul, the flood, lasting 40 days and 40 nights. According to Christian tradition, Jesus fasted in the wilderness for 40 days. And we have something in 40 days also. I think we call that Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai, also 40 days. So there were references to 40 days, some kind of a purification. After childbirth, the mothers expected to rest for 40 days and so on. So that was why they picked 40 days. In any event, by the way, just as a point, there is still this form of bubonic plague today. The World Health Organization reports that there are approximately 1,000 to 3,000 cases worldwide of this plague still today. But in any event, the renewed religious fervor and fanaticism, religious fervor combined with ignorance, combined with distrust of the other, combined with lack of confidence in knowing what's going on, it's a soup that it's a mixture that's toxic, and therefore Jews, among others, at least initially, it wasn't only Jews. It was other foreigners, beggars, pilgrims, other people who were different, lepers, Romani, the so-called gypsies, and so on. They were blamed for the crisis. Lepers certainly, and even people with other type of skin diseases like acne and psoriasis. Okay. Which are ordinary disease, they were killed because they felt there was something to do with the skin. So they were, they were people killed for this. But one of the things which caught on in terms of the Jews was the, of course, were age-old victims of blame, age-old scapegoats. One of the physicians, the doctor in Avignon, wrote as follows. Many hesitated in some countries. Well, let me get before that. I'm sorry. Let's read over here. The exact quote I was looking for. Yeah. I was right. Okay. Many hesitated in some countries. People believe that the Jews intended to poison the whole world and therefore kill them. In other countries, they expelled paupers suffering from deformity, and yet others, even the noblemen's. And sometimes itinerant monks were suspected of placing the poison, spreading the disease, and they were attacked instead. But the idea of poisoning the wells is something which caught on. Okay, we'll see shortly that it caught on because, unfortunately, some Jews, because they were being tortured, confessed and admitted to poisoning wells. They didn't do it, but they felt they had to admit it because to get out of torture. Okay, so many, many Jewish communities were attacked. The official church policy at that time was to protect the Jews, okay, at that point. The Jews, as I said before, were scapegoated for other things, and here they were accused of causing disease by poisoning the wells. Now, some have suggested that the reason the Jews were a legitimate or a reasonable target is because they seemed to suffer less or have less accounts or less cases of the plague than others. That has really not been substantiated, and it does not really appear to be true, but that was a theory, okay? And again, the combination of religious fanaticism, ignorance, superstition, and the dislike of the other sort of kind of combined, to make a volatile situation for Jews. Were Jews less affected? Well, it is conceivable that it was slightly less affected. People point to the fact that in terms of hygiene, which was not, in the Middle Ages at that time, practiced the proper way, everybody, Jews did have to practice hygiene in a manner that others didn't, whether it's washing from the tilsidayim, washing in the morning, tilsidayim and shachris, women using the mikveh, and so on. And while it is conceivable that the total the percentage of Jews who were affected may have been somewhat less than in other groups, but again, as I said, it's really difficult to say that the Jews, it's simply not the case that the Jews did not suffer and die from the Black Plague at all. Okay, just to give an example of some incidents, cases, Spanish Jews were charged with the scheme of sending out messengers with the poison and threatening excommunication to their co-religious, the fellow Jews, to coerce them into the plan. The supposed poison was concocted from spiders, frogs, lizards, and or from the hearts of dead Christians, and the dough of the consecrated wafer, the cookie, the cracker that the Catholics eat in church. In May of 1348, a Jewish congregation in southern France, including men, women, and children, together with their holy writings, were burned, okay, and other things which we'll see in a moment. But that was what the Jews were accused of spreading the disease by concocting some kind of a potion or powder, which would be poured into the water. And that would, now, of course, the Jews had to drink the same water. So it's on face really irrational and difficult to understand. But we have to put ourselves in the shoes of the people at that time. This terrible plague is wreaking havoc on society. Okay, no apparent reason. Physicians, quote unquote, such as they were at that time, are at a complete loss to explain what's going on. It's obviously, quote unquote, some kind of divine punishment. And what better people to blame than the Jews? And so they concocted this whole idea that the Jews were poisoning the wells and they were looking to take over by getting rid of all their Christian neighbors. And it really was, again, irrational. But the fact is, maybe Jews in some communities perhaps had somewhat less of a lower percentage level of incidences of the disease, but we're not at all not impacted by it. Many Jews died as well. The first massacres relating directly to the plague took place in April of 1348 in Toulon in Provence, where the Jewish quarter was sacked. 40 Jews were murdered in their homes. The next was in Barcelona. In 1349, massacres and persecution spread across Europe, including the Erfurt massacre, the Basel massacre, massacres in Aragon, Flanders. 2,000 Jews, we'll see in a moment, were burnt alive. 2,000 Jews were burnt alive on February 14, 1349, in the so-called Valentine's Day massacre in Strasbourg. That was before the plague even came to Strasbourg, by the way. Okay. And while the ashes of people smoldered, the Christian residents of Strasbourg sifted through the ashes and helped themselves to valuable possessions of the Jews who had just died there. We won't minimize the fact that after the Jews were killed, their properties were up for grabs. Okay. In the spring of 1349, the Jewish community of Frankfurt am Main was completely annihilated. Similarly, in Magenza and Cologne, the 3,000-strong Jewish population of Magenza initially defended themselves. They held off their attackers for a while, but eventually they overwhelmed the Jewish ghetto and killed all the Jews. In Spire, the Jewish corpses were disposed of in wine casks and cast into the Rhine River. By the close of 1349, the worst of the pogroms ended in the Rhineland, but the massacres of Jews elsewhere started. And by the year 1351, there had been at least, according to the records, 350 incidents of anti-Jewish pogroms and 60 major and 150 minor Jewish communities, 210 altogether, if you want to do the math, had been totally exterminated. And this caused the eastward movement of Northern Europeans, Jewry, to Poland and Lithuania, where they remained for the next six centuries. We'll come back to the point at the end. King Casimir III of Poland enthusiastically welcomed the Jews into Poland. And that started a major shift in the center of Jewish activity in terms of Jewish learning, and even in terms of Jewish learning and scholarship, was as a result of the Black Plague. Anyway, so once the Jews were accused of poisoning the wells, so entire Jewish communities, as we said, we just saw, were completely obliterated. 3,000 here, 2,000 there, just numbers, but staggering numbers, certainly. And as I said before about the flagellants, when they came into the cities starting in 1348, they also attacked the Jews, while bleeding themselves. And so even if Jews weren't killed, they were wounded, they were hurt, and were victims of violence. As the plague moved through Austria and Switzerland, so did the anti-Semitic massacres following it along the Rhine River. Okay, again, in towns throughout Germany and France, Jewish communities were completely annihilated, and again, Jews moved to the east. It's interesting, just as a side point, okay, even in secular history records, there are reference to the fact that the Jews have to wash their hands before eating bread, after using the bathroom, bathing for Shabbos, women going to ritual baths, and so on and so forth. So just interesting, it's recognized even among non-Jewish sources, the Jews may practice better hygiene. But again, it was certainly not sufficient to suggest that this was enough. Now, in many cities, the truth is, and it has to be stated, the civil authorities tried to help, or the religious authorities. The Pope at that time was Clement VI, okay? He tried to protect the Jewish communities, issuing two papal decrees known as papal bulls, okay, in 1348, one on July 6th, one on September 26th, saying that those who blamed the plague on the Jews had been seduced by that liar, the devil, okay? And he went on to emphasize, quote, "It cannot be true that the Jews, by such a heinous crime, are the cause or the occasion of the plague, because through many parts of the world, the same plague, by the hidden judgment of God, has afflicted and continues to afflict the Jews themselves and many other races who have never lived alongside them." So he urged the local clergy to take action to protect the Jews and offer them papal protection in the city of Avignon. And in this, Clement was aided by the research of his personal physician, the doctor, okay, who argued from his own treatment that the Jews were not to blame. So the more rational thinkers, the more educated among Christian leaders did not feel that the Jews were to blame, and indeed thought it was silly. In fact, the one person wrote, it's impossible to suggest the Jews drink the same wells as we do. Okay, and the Pope and others tried to convince Christians that since this pestilence is all but universal everywhere, obviously it affects Jews and non-Jews, and it makes absolutely no sense to blame the Jews. It's very nice for the intelligentsia, for the leaders, for the Pope, for the religious leaders to say this. However, Clement's efforts were undone by the mobs, by the common people, and by the fact that in many places the civil authorities looked the other way or even helped the rioters. We can talk about that in contemporary times also, the civil authorities looking the other way, but that happened then. And the Jews also were victims of that because, and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles IV declared that the property of Jews killed in the riots is up for grabs. He declared it a hefker. We have a principle called hefker, bezen, hefker. Well, he invoked the concept of hefker, bezen, hefker, lahavdil also, and said that, you know, the Jews' property is up for grabs. Well, that didn't exactly encourage civil authorities to try and put down the massacre of Jews, okay? And again, really this was unique or a turn in history because this was not economic oppression against Jews. It was not unfair taxation. This was not making the Jews wear a yellow star, which was an old practice. The Nazis didn't invent that, as most of you I'm sure know. This was something else. This was simply one word, slaughter, okay? The mobs, the masses ignored the Pope's decrees, okay, the King Karl IV of Germany made a policy and public statements that the Jews are to be, you know, spared and so on, but most of the masses did not obey. The extremist religious groups, local people, and economically and socially motivated murderers got busy. And again, as we said before, literally 210 Jewish communities were destroyed and Jews were massacred. In Basel, as I mentioned before, in Switzerland, really right near the building where 550 years later the first Zionist Congress would take place, right there more than 1,000 Jews were killed, you know, right in that area. There were Jews in other areas who committed suicide rather than you know, than given to the Christians. And again, as I said before, there are halachas which would guide us in terms of cleanliness. There's a Gemara Bava Kama that the people have been quoting in the wake of the corona situation, that the Gemara says that, you know, go, you know, when there's a disease, go into your homes and keep yourself socially isolated, or, you know, don't eat a piece of bread and then put it in a bowl of food and be careful how you eat and so on, spreading germs. But as I said before, it's simply not provable that we can't say with any certainty that Jews died in any greater or lesser numbers than anybody else. So in any event, that was not relevant to people. The fact that an opportunity to take revenge on somebody We speak about the fact that today certain riots that are going on in the United States today are because people were cooped up on account of Corona, and there was frustration. Well, again, multiply the frustration manifold at that time when people literally dying all over the place and buried in the means that I described earlier, that were described by the eyewitnesses to the accounts and to the events. You can imagine the frustration. Jews were an easy target, and there were disasters that that simply befell the community as a result. They were compounded, as I mentioned earlier, by the fact that some Jews actually admitted poisoning wells. So on October 20th, 1348, a Jew by the name of Agimet, I'm not sure it's pronounced, of Geneva, writes as follows, and this was recorded, the year of our Lord, 1340, recorded by the authorities. Okay, I'm not going to read the whole thing to save some time, but the Jew, Agimet, who lived in Geneva, was arrested, was put to torture a little. I don't know how you define a little torture, you know. But anyway, and he was released, and after a long time, having been subjected again to torture a little, okay, he confessed in the presence of many authorities, and he said, and it's clear that he and others, Jews, participated. He said, and there's a certain Rabbi Peret, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, another Jew who was their teacher of the law, who sent for this Jew, he claimed. And he came to him and said, we've been informed you're going to Venice to buy silk and other wares. I'm giving you a little package, a small size, which contains some prepared poison and venom in a thin sewed leather bag. Distribute it there in Venice among the wells, the cisterns, and the springs around Venice, okay, and to other places where you go. In order to poison the people who use the water of those wells, they'll have been poisoned by you, namely the wells in which the poison you will have been placed. And so this Jew, supposedly listening to his rabbi, we know everybody always listens to their rabbi. So he listened to his rabbi, and he took a package of this full of poison to Venice. And he claimed that when he got there, he threw it into the wells and into the cisterns of fresh water near different places in town. He also said that the aforementioned rabbi promised to give him whatever he wanted for his troubles in his business. And of his own accord, this is the Christian account, of his own accord, this Jew confessed further that this, after this had been done, he left and, he went to another place and did the same thing in other towns, and he confessed further that he put some of this poison into the city of Toulouse and the wells near the Mediterranean Sea. And so this confession, which was great detail, the names of places and people, and the name of a certain rabbi, of course, this was imaginary. This was a tortured man who was past his breaking point, who was willing to say anything to stop the torture. Okay, a very similar confession was elicited by the Jew by the name of Balavigne, who confessed that a certain Rabbi Jacob from Toledo, in not in Ohio, but in Spain, had sent him to poison, distribute poison in certain wells likewise, okay? And what it was done for was to punish the Christians for their evil treatment of the Jews and so on. And, of course, these quote-unquote confessions, which were taken literally, which were believed by those listening to them who were eager to believe it because they had no other explanation, angered, of course, people, the Jews. He said, forgiveness is granted for every transgression. And I mentioned that Charles IV, that's the Holy Roman Emperor, said, forgiveness is granted for every transgression involving the slaying and destruction of Jews, which has been committed without the positive knowledge of leading citizens or in their ignorance or in any other fashion whatsoever. So declaring Jewish property hefker contributed to things as well. Just some accounts of the Jewish suffering. I mentioned that on St. Valentine's Day, what they call St. Valentine's Day, which has different meaning today in the United States among non-religious Christians, but among the religion, Christians call it St. Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1349. Okay. The Jews, after hearing these confessions and so on and so forth, Jews were arrested. The Bishop of Strasbourg and various other officials rounded up Jews. They asked on that Shabbos, which was St. Valentine's Day, they burnt the Jews on a wooden platform in their cemetery. There were about 2,000 of them. Those who agreed to baptize themselves were spared. Some say that close to 1,000 accepted baptism. Many small children were taken out of fire and baptized against the will of their parents, and everything that was owed to the Jews was canceled. All debts, the Jews had to surrender everything, all debts and pledges and IOUs and so on and so forth. Okay, so this, as I said before, contributed to it. And at least 1,000, between 1,000 and 2,000 Jews perished in this terrible massacre in the city of Strasbourg. Actually, by the way, they banned Jews from living in Strasbourg, which lasted about 100 years. Just want to read to you, and again, this happened in so many different places. Here is an epitaph for a young boy named Usher Ben Turiel, which was remained inscribed in his tombstone for hundreds of years in the Jewish cemetery in Toledo, Spain. And we can learn a great deal from his father's farewell to his dead son about how the Jews of Toledo lived at that time. Here is an English translation of what it says on this young boy's stone. This stone is a memorial. That's a pasuk chumash. Eidah ha-matzeva hazos and so on. Eidah galah zeidah ha-matzeva. That a later generation may know that underneath it lies hidden a pleasant bud, a cherished child, perfect in knowledge, a reader of the Bible, a student of Mishnah and Gemara, had learned from his father what his father learned from his teachers, the statutes of God and his laws. Though only 15 years in age, he was like a man of 80 in knowledge, more blessed than all sons. Usher, may he rest in paradise, the son of Yosef ben Turiel, may God comfort him. He died of the plague in the month of Tammuz in the year 1349. But a few days before his death, he established his home. Yesternight, the joyous voice of the bride and groom was turned to the voice of wailing, and the father is left sad and aching. May the God of heaven grant him comfort and send another child to restore his soul. 40 years later, the French Jewish physician, Jacob Ben Salomon, wrote a work entitled Great Mourning, in which he described his daughter Esther's last moments. She died of a later outbreak of the Great Plague in 1383, weeks after her brother and sister also died. Esther expressed her few final wishes on her deathbed. She asked that her money be donated to Tzedakah and her clothes to the poor. She asked that her uncle leave the room before her death because as a Kohen, he was forbidden from being in the presence of the dead, and that her husband not come to her side because she was ritually impure according to the laws of Nida. She asked that her husband name a future daughter after her and that her sister not take her place as his wife. Yaakov and Solomon eulogized his children by noting that during Esther's formal final moments, she strictly observed the letter of Jewish law. People committed to modesty, even at the last moment. Interrupt myself to point out that I remember a Lav Dafka Jewish person, I don't know, but it struck me so much. When I visited the museum in Manhattan, the 9/11, September 11th museum by the site of where the World Trade Center stood, it's a wonderful museum. I was there for many, many hours, probably 5 or 6 hours going through that museum. They warned you before going into this little room, it was very graphic. They showed pictures of people jumping out of the upper floors because the heat was so intense. And one thing that struck me, and they make a note of it in the exhibit, that a woman stood by the window and she was wearing a dress and she was about to jump out the window. But as she stood by the window, it's so high up, so you have wind, she clutched her dress close to her body. She protected her modesty. Even she's about to jump out the window, she still felt she had to behave in a modest fashion. I have no idea whether this was an observant woman, a Jewish woman or not, but this is what reminded me of this, of a young lady dying on her deathbed, cleaving closely to the halachas as she understood them. Now, we know that well before the year 1348, Jews had been subject to various episodes of violence and pogroms and so on and so forth. We know this, okay? But this really brought it to a different level. Franciscan friar Hermann Gigas writes, in a number of regions, many people, noble and humble alike, laid plans against the Jews and their defenders, which they will never abandon until the whole Jewish race has been destroyed. That's what we call in modern language the final solution. The circulating the plot against Christianity from that Jew in Spain who admitted that, carried forth by this Rabbi Peret, whatever his name was, and so on and so forth. Jews were tortured. And again, admitted certain things which you would admit perhaps under torture. And the Jews were therefore perceived as the enemy. They were the convenient scapegoat for this disaster. A professor of medical history at Yale, Professor Paul Friedman writes, it's a radical shift in the notion of Jews, not as outcasts, but as dangerous. Now, that's a major change with the blaming the Jews for the Black Death. Jews were not outcasts or killers of God, Christ killers, Jesus killers, or whatever. It's not, now Jews are dangerous, okay, and they can infect people, okay. And it's one thing to talk about minorities. He writes this, for example, people talk disparagingly. It's one thing to talk about this minority as being lazy, that minority is being dirty, that minority is being unintelligent. But it's a very different thing when you start referring to them as rapists, murderers, a danger to public safety, and so on. And this elevates the contempt to a different order of magnitude. These people are in immediate danger. And this was what was happening to the Jews during the Black Plague. They were in immediate danger. And of course, many Jews attempted to resist. I mentioned before, the Jews in Mainz succeeded in staving off the mob for a short time. They killed 200 of the attackers, but inevitably the counterattack began, and eventually more than 6,000 Jews died in that city. Okay, the mayor of Strasbourg, but I should have mentioned this before, okay, the mayor of Strasbourg, who refused to give credence to the rumors that it was the Jews' fault, they voted him out of office, simple as that. Okay, he was removed from his post. Okay, and more than 2,000 of them were put together, as I mentioned before. I just want to read now one eyewitness account from a contemporary chronicler, what happened as to what happened in Strasbourg on that Valentine's Day massacre. In defiance of the murderers, some Jews were dancing, others were singing psalms, some were crying when they went into the flames. Jews in some places burned their own homes and all their property rather than let their wealth fall into the hands of the people who persecuted them. The scene of the murders of Strasbourg might have been ugly indeed. Jews were brought to the place of execution and probably attacked by mobs who tore off their clothes in an attempt to rob and humiliate them further. Apparently a few, in a desperate attempt to save themselves from a terrible death, gave up their faith and became baptized. The lurid stares of some of the Christian men probably fell on the attractive naked Jewish women, and some of them were retrieved from the execution. But it will be impossible to tell as to whether they were abused and what happened to them next. Perhaps the unwillingness of some of them to be saved from the flames demonstrated their faith, demonstrated their lack of faith, and I hope we understand it, okay? But again, this is a description of the mad scene that would take place before the massacres of Jews. I mentioned the community of Worms, hundreds of Jews killed. In Magenz, no less than 6,000 perished. And basically, the mobs, in effect, in Erfurt, Germany got away with the 3,000. The mobs pretty much carried out what they wanted to do. I mentioned before that the official position of the church was not to harm the Jews, but it didn't make a difference. And people screaming, kill the traitors, mobs being incited by religious fanatics like these flagellants or others, okay, entering homes, looting, and being allowed to keep what they looted and so on. This kind of mass hysteria, this kind of mass rioting brought down the society. And in the case of the Jews, led to, you know, really unprecedented massacres. And here is an account, we're almost finished, of a Jew by the name of Chaim Gali Papa in Barcelona. It was preserved in the Chronicles of Yosef HaKohen, who wrote a book on this matter. I have it here in Hebrew, but I'll read it in English. About 20 people were killed and despoiled. Nobody said hold back. The uprising was continuing when a storm broke out and those who had risen up against the Jews took fright. The Lord confused their speech. Then came the elders of the city and the leading men. They rescued the survivors. Before the thunder and rain had scared them, there were many who were riding against the Jews and saying, exterminate them from among the nations. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more. The Pasuk of the Chumash, of course. Okay. After some days, people in the town of Kavera rose up against the Jews, killing another 18 of them and despoiling them and seizing their property. Survivors fled, mortifying their souls with fasting and sackcloth and ashes and suffering greatly. After three more days, and here we come, on the 10th day of the month of Av, and it must have been a Nidcha that year, the inhabitants of Terego also rose up against the Jews and killed more than 300 people, dragged them to an empty cistern, piled the bodies there, and despoiled everything. So we do have a Tisha B'Av connection as well. There always seems to be. And as I said before, even in cities where the plague did not yet arrive, nonetheless, the license, so to speak, to kill Jews, destroy Jews, that was already there. And the efforts of the Pope and others were unable to accomplish anything. And so that's just some insight into the horrors of the Black Plague. Okay, by the time the Black Plague appeared in Europe, Christianity, of course, was was in power, and their scapegoats for the pestilence were the Jews, who were accused of poisoning wells and everything else that we mentioned, and thousands were killed. Within a year, Jews from Cologne and Austria were burnt, many burnt alive. Jews were burnt in a building which was designed or built for that purpose in one place. And they were, as I said, they were the convenient scapegoats for this disaster. And really, the Black Plague, I'm surprised, actually, I don't have any knowledge as to why there is no kina, and the kinnas that we say on Tisha B'Av for the Jewish lives that were lost in this fashion. Why it wasn't composed, I can't answer the question. Whether it was a massacre in Strasbourg or any of the other occasions or any other massacres that we mentioned. But again, this history of hate led to disaster for Jews, and if I may conclude, to something which, shall we say, changed the history of Jews, or history of Jews as the enemy. Okay. First of all, the idea of blaming Jews for plagues, that happened other times as well. The cholera epidemics, the Jews were blamed. Okay. And initially, when the coronavirus first broke out, you can see my son-in-law, who does work with Muslim groups, showed me cartoons from Muslim newspapers blaming the Jews for the corona outbreak. He sent me a bunch of them. Someone's interested, I can send you them. Okay, I think that died down pretty quickly, but initially, Jews were convenient. Those who hate Jews were a convenient scapegoat for the outbreak of corona as well. As I said before, it came down to the 20th century because an outbreak of typhus was used by the Nazis. The Nazis referred to typhus as a Jewish plague. Okay, and the official propaganda that the Jews were subhuman and inferior to those of the pure Aryan stock, which was, of course, a major piece of Nazi literature and Nazi ideology. The Jews were dirty, and the disease typhoid with typhus was spread because of the Jewish filth. So the Nazis used this and this kind of propaganda, and the idea of locking the Jews in ghettos, okay, or even eliminating Jews, was done as a disease control method. Okay, as you may know, from having visited or read about the concentration camps, they were supposed to be disinfected, right? There were gas camps, there were gas chambers, but they're supposed to be disinfected, right? Because Jews were infected, Jews were dirty, Jews were filthy, and so on and so forth. So the Nazis used this same idea, which had been used with great effect during the time of the Black Death. Blaming it on the Jews was used, less than 100 years ago by Nazis to justify ghettoizing the Jews and even eliminating the Jews as a disease control method. But there's something else also that's very important. The idea that with this was confession presented was that there's such a thing which is known as the international Jew, that a Jew from this place would travel to a different place at the direction of his rabbi for the purpose of killing and poisoning wells and killing the inhabitants. That's the Jew. The Jew is scheming against everybody else in the world, the so-called international Jew. Of course, made more famous in the 1800s by the notorious Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But this idea seems to have originated really at the time of the Black Death. Okay, not just blaming Jews as dangerous, again, used by the Nazis, but the second thing, that there's such a concept of a Jew or the group of Jews secretly plotting against all the Christians, regardless of what country. This was a worldwide kind of Jewish scheme, so to speak. Okay, and that was something which, again, as we say, was introduced at this time, at the time of the Black Plague. Just to read to you one or two other quotes, and we're finished, literally a minute or so. This book on Antisemitism by Paul E. Grosser and Edward G. Halpern, The Cause and Effects of Paradise, they write, "The period of the Black Death is extremely important in the history and development of antisemitism. As the plague killed thousands, an explanation for it developed that had repercussions for the Jews down to the present. The myth was invented that an international Jewish conspiracy aimed at the extermination of Christians was the cause of the plague. The Jewish leadership in Spain, according to that account we read earlier, allegedly directed Jewish communities throughout Europe to poison wells and cause sickness and death. This myth was attacked again and again by the more responsible Christian leader, but it captured the imagination of the masses and was believed in the face of evidence to the contrary and its patent absurdity." Okay, and while it's true the Jews were charged with conspiracy in the past, those earlier charges of conspiracy did not include every Jew wherever he lived. Some of them, I didn't read the whole thing, but some of them said every Jew above the age of 7 years old was aware and part of this conspiracy. And this myth of the international Jewish conspiracy, which originated in the Black Death, still persists today, and of course was made was made famous by the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So that notion of the the international Jew. Also, this period also saw, again, the continuation of the older anti-Semitic rhetoric, ritual murder, right, blood libel, host desecration, all these kinds of things, were continued parts of Jewish persecution. But the third thing, again, I mentioned three lasting impacts. One is, again, was blaming Jews for as being dangerous physically, blaming Jews for disease and so on. Two, the concept of the international Jew. And finally, okay, the idea that the Jews fled Western Europe and moved eastward. Okay, Germany had been the center of Jewish life, including Jewish religious life, for a couple hundred years. All right, the Balei HaTosfos, Rashi was from France. I mentioned this morning the Kinnas. Rashi came from France, and really there was no one to learn with in France. He was sent to learn with Germany. The schools of the Balei HaTosfos were from Germany. And I'm going to say it again, those who heard me say it in shul, but I'll say it again. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, and again, you wouldn't necessarily expect him to say this, but he said that had Jewish history not seen the Rambam, not seen a person like the Rambam, he said Torah Shebaal Peh could have survived. We've been deprived of one of the great thinkers, one of the great minds of all time, and the impact of the Rambam is immeasurable, not minimizing it. But he said Torah Shebaal Peh could have survived. Without the Balei HaTosfos, Rashi and the Balei HaTosfos, the Rav said, Jewish Torah Shebaal Peh would not have survived. They made it accessible and readable and so on. You don't read a page of Gemara without Rashi. I've sometimes sent to students, sometimes we get frustrated with studying Gemara and we're frustrated, we can't understand a line, and we look for Rashi and Rashi doesn't say anything. And you say to yourself, just the line I don't understand, Rashi doesn't say anything. You wouldn't understand any line if there weren't Rashi. Not just the line you're reading now. You wouldn't understand any lines without Rashi, without Tosfos and so on. And this was in Germany, centered in Germany, the Balei HaTosfos and the German Pietists and so on, the great authorities. But the Black Death really marked more or less the end of Germany as the center of Jewish life. We don't really have, yes, I'm not saying there weren't subsequent Talmud Chachamim in Germany, of course there were, okay, but it began to shift eastward. Okay, Poland, I mentioned the king of Poland, Casimir III, welcomed the Jews into Poland, and that shift eastward started in the aftermath of the Black Plague. It continued thereafter, and soon the center of Jewish life became more in Eastern Europe than in Western Europe, down until the present, down until the Holocaust sort of took care of all of Europe. So those are lasting impacts of the Black Death. Again, blame the Jews, we're the convenient scapegoat, and people even applied it today a little bit, at least at the beginning, to the coronavirus. Again, at least in that regard, calmer heads and more rational minds prevailed. Nonetheless, this was a very, very dark period in Jewish life, perhaps not really explored enough. And again, I don't have an explanation of why there's no kinna, why we don't have other things commemorating as we do other tragedies. Perhaps someone can suggest that. I don't know. There are not that many written records, and maybe that's why. I don't know. But it's an interesting question. Nonetheless, it behooves us to be a little bit aware of this event in the mid-1300s, which cost the lives of so many Jews and so many Jewish communities. Wish everybody a meaningful rest of the fast, and hopefully we'll have the opportunity in future years to discuss more cheerful topics, and who knows, maybe if Tisha B'Av is turned into Yontif, we'll give a share in the afternoon on joyous occasions in Jewish history throughout the centuries and millennia. Have a meaningful rest of the fast.
No. Thank you.
Questions. I'm happy to answer questions if to the best I can. I'll stay on.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Talbis.
By the way, the pasuk that I quoted earlier mentioned about the going to wipe out the Jews was not a pasuk in Torah. Someone pointed and I said Torah, I meant Novi. It's from the Novi. Sorry.
Actually, I think it might be Tehillim.
Right, let me tell you. I don't know what I say. No, I got it. Watch it. No, definitely not. Definitely not. Cheers, right. Yes. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, very well.
Thank you.
Get together, bro. We should all get together for a specific occasion, for a joyous occasion. Okay, I'm ending it.